Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Very glad to be here in the garage with two experts on the JonBenet Ramsey case and experts on the city of Boulder around the time of the murder as well. The gentlemen joining me today are brothers, the Zell brothers, Jim and Frank, and they've been looking at the JonBenet Ramsey case almost since day one. So they started looking at this case early 1997. One thing that I really enjoyed and I thought was a breath of fresh air when we first met for the first time, guys, you told me about something that you call the Boulder Syndrome. Could you explain again to me what that is and to our wonderful listeners what it is that you call the Boulder Syndrome?
Well, thanks for having us on, Nick. We appreciate the time.
Thank you, Nick.
The Boulder Syndrome, that's what our original theory morphed into. In January of 1997, we devised our own theory about the case. We called it the sex ring theory. We do not believe that John or Patsy Ramsey killed their child, but maybe were involved in something which put their daughter in harm's way and led to her death. That was our theory. And as we looked into Boulder, as the days went on, the weeks, the months, the years, we started finding out that there were all these cases and we were getting bits of information about things that not many people knew about and involving child sexual abuse. So it, for us, it became bigger than the JonBenet Ramsey case, and we call it the Boulder Syndrome. We use the word syndrome because in medical terminology, what is a syndrome? It is a series of symptoms that repeat over and over. And that's how we view Boulder, that they have had a pedophile problem in that town for decades.
Yeah, so. It's always been painted Boulder as this perfect town, but there is an extremely dark side to it. Underneath the surface, it's really dark.
And that's what I found so amazing. Some of the cases that you guys pointed out to me, you know, we have Lawrence Schiller's book, and I think it's a fantastic book. It chronicles a lot of the events and the movements about this case early on. Perfect Murder, Perfect Town, JonBenet and the City of Boulder. But as you guys quickly pointed out to me, not so fast there, Nick, this is not the perfect town, and here's why. So let's take the listeners through some of the child sex, some of the grosser, more disturbing things that were going on in Boulder, starting with the Slusher case.
The Slusher case, this was a case that started out early on in Hunter's career. So Hunter, Alex Hunter, the district attorney, who at the time of the Ramsey murder, he was elected into office around 1972. And this case happened in 1977. You had a man, the name of Floyd David Slusher, arrested in 1977 for molesting Boy Scouts. And we found out about this case when the Boy Scouts released their files about pedophiles who had worked for their organization. And we pretty much, when they did that, we pretty much guaranteed that we'll definitely find a Boulder connection. And we found Floyd David Slusher. So he arrested in 77. He was convicted on one count of sexual assault on a minor, and he was sentenced one day to life, which I had never heard of before, and he served about 6 years. Now, as we started digging in to Mr. Slusher, we found the investigating officer's notes. This was an officer Dutroux of the sheriff's office, the Boulder County Sheriff's Office. And the things he wrote about Slusher were incredible. For example, this is a quote from the handwritten notes of that 77 case. Dutroux stated that he, quote, learned of many victims too numerous to interview. So right there, that gives you pause. What do you mean that they were too numerous to interview? You didn't interview everybody? There were so many you stopped? So that was problem number one. And Dutroux also stated that Slusher sexually approached every Boy Scout troop in Troop 75 and Troop 73, and that Slusher chose victims outside of scouting as well. It is evident, however, that Slusher, through his sexual assaults on young boys, has affected many young lives. And the most distressing part of it was when Dutroux stated, parents of one of the victims may have been directly promoting a relationship between their son and the suspect. That is in what the old terminology that we use. Two or more people that are involved in abusing a child is called a sex ring. That's what we always called it and still do. Today, you call it human trafficking. So this case ends up, he's arrested for several counts, and Hunter and his office plead him down to one count. Now, the parents of the other kids were outraged. But Hunter tried to calm them down, but saying, look, if we charge them, if we do all eight, it's going to come out to the same sentence. And that was said to kind of keep the parents at bay. But what the parents didn't know about were the handwritten notes by Officer Dutroux. Hunter didn't have to plead them out. He could have went back to Dutroux and interviewed the numerous amount of witnesses that they didn't interview. And you could have hit them with a slew of charges and kept them in prison for a much longer time. But that didn't happen. And that's, for us, where it starts. I'm sure there's cases before 77, but you're going to see a common theme with, like, everybody bashes the police department, and we do too, but the district attorney's office, they're the ones who were really at fault, in our opinion.
And Slusher's, when he was initially arrested, you know, the acts that he was accused of being committed at the time, they were atrocious, horrible, but yet you had many people come to his defense. You had professors write letters to the judge. You had lawyers that were not representing him, obviously, but they were writing letters for him to be lenient, if not straight out released.
They wanted him released on bond, if you could believe it. This and Slusher did this by the he did all this by the ripe old age of 24 years old.
Yeah, they usually start. They usually the statistics will tell us that they usually start at that late teens, early 20s age for this type of behavior, these type of gross actions and crimes. And what we're seeing here is, I think with the Slusher case, I look at that one and I go, well, this is showing me that either these molestation cases, and I don't know the details of some of the crimes that he committed, but the molestation cases, especially in the 70s, they were handled a lot differently back then than they are today. And so that could be a little bit a sign of the times kind of thing. But I think you're right. What we're going to see with some of these cases is either some kind of disconnect where we're not convicting these people to the fullest extent of the law. And why are we not doing that? And what's behind that? So let's move forward, guys, to 84. I believe it was 1984, the Sid Wells case.
I believe it was 1983, Nick. Okay. It was the murder of Sid Wells by the person arrested for the murder. His name was Thane Smyka. And this is where you're going to hear how Alex Hunter handled. It wasn't just the Ramsey grand jury that he was kind of messing around with. He kind of screwed with the Sid Wells grand jury and made deals. And just to touch on, because we're going to actually get to that, maybe touch on it with this case as well. When you said that in the 70s, they handled cases different. In Boulder, it never changed.
Right.
From the 70s to the 80s to the 90s and after, that district attorney's office, that's all they did was make crazy plea bargains in pedophile cases. And we'll touch on that. But as for Thane Smyka, Sid Wells was, he brought Thane in as a roommate to help pay the rent. Thane was usually late with the rent, which Sid Wells complained about. And Thane was a bit of a drug user, also a drug dealer. And the brother of Sid Wells went camping, came home one day and found his brother shot in the back of the head with a shotgun. So that's and Thane Smyka isn't there. He had left a note on the table stating that he was elsewhere, wouldn't be back till a certain time. That was his kind of his alibi. Look, it was his shotgun. He left the note on top of the blood. So he was arrested. But Hunter did something very, very strange. He made a deal. He had a grand jury formed to investigate the case. And it was just, he made a deal that was so strange that the detectives working on the case weren't aware of it. And after it was over, they actually looked into seeing if Alex Hunter committed illegal acts by doing this. Hunter and Smyka's attorneys agreed in writing that the grand jury convened to investigate the case would not indict Smyka. That was the deal Hunter made with Smyka's attorney. And they also agreed that Smyka's mother and sister would not be called as witnesses. Why? Because Smyka's own mother said he did the murder. So what happens? They make that deal. And in exchange, Smyka's attorney allows Smyka to remain in police custody, even though no charges are formally filed against him. Now, they only have so much time to hold him. Then they release him. He sticks around Boulder for a period of time, and then he disappears. And to this day, they're still looking for him. That's how Alex Hunter handled that case.
Let's push forward and go to the Downsboro case.
Bruce Downsboro was working for the University of Tennessee when he was arrested in 2013. And he was caught up in this worldwide investigation, and it was called Project Spade. And this Project Spade was, they were investigating a Canadian film company called Azov Films. And this Azov Films, they were into child torture pornography. So Bruce Downsboro was caught up in this. He was arrested, and there were some other people arrested in this. U.S. Senator Lamar Alexander's chief of staff, his name was Jesse Ryan Larskin. He was also arrested, but he wound up committing suicide. There were about 350 people in total that were arrested in this investigation. And then going back to Downsboro, he had about 20,000 images that were on his computer. And this is some of the most brutal stuff, the abuse and torture of toddlers, you know, really horrific material. Downsboro, this is where he was arrested in Tennessee, but there's a tie-in. It goes back to Boulder, Colorado, you know, and Downsboro was arrested in Boulder, Colorado in 1986.
Jim, I'm sorry if I don't mean to jump over you.
Sure, go ahead.
You know, in the 80s, Bruce Downsboro lived, you know, in Boulder and in the surrounding area, and he worked at the College of Boulder in the grants department. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Jim. Continue. Sorry about that.
No, that's true. Yeah, he lived there, and he was a lawyer, mm-hmm. and he molested two boys, and he pleaded guilty to sexual assault on a child and sexual assault in the third degree. Obviously, you know, the common pattern, no jail time is ever given in these cases. In the first case, he received a deferment. And in the second case, he received, I think it was 2 years probation. And he also mentioned to Tennessee investigators that he also molested other children as well. But that was never really pursued.
Yeah, his words were he got away with it.
Yeah, he got away with it. That's right. So, and what's interesting about this is John Ramsey's Access Graphics was the subsidiary of Lockheed Martin. And in the 90s, Lockheed Martin was the United States' number one defense contractor. Going back to 1986, the number one defense contractor was H.R.B. Singer. And the president of that company in 1986 was George Downsboro, Bruce's father. You're going to see a pattern. The more we share stories of, you know, you're going to see lawyers, city officials, people of prominence, police caught up in deviant activity. So that's the Downsboro in a nutshell.
And then these cases are already very disturbing, but one that really takes the disturbing cake is the Ballard case.
The Ballard case is known to be the most horrific sex abuse case in Colorado history. You had Mike Ballard and Patricia Ballard with their friends, Dennis Dunham and his wife, and they were abusing the Ballard kids. And I believe there was five of them.
Seven kids.
And it was torture, sexual abuse, incest, you name it. These kids were going through it. And they kind of had a system going where they would abuse in one town, and when DHS came and got wise, they would move to another town and continue the abuse. And they would get visited, and the kids would have all types of, you know, damage to their bodies, cigarette burns, bite marks, but they were never taken out of the home. They were never taken away from them. They were even brought before a judge with a broken limbs, and they were still sent back to the Ballards. So this went on for a period of, you know, years. They were eventually arrested in 93 when finally they took the children out of the home and placed them in a foster home. And when they felt comfortable enough, they told the foster parents what was going on. And that's how the arrests were finally made, after the kids disclosed the horrific abuse that they were experiencing at the hands of the Ballards and the Dunnans. But it kind of expands, though. It's not just the Ballards and the Dunnans, because when we received the affidavits for this case, when you read the police reports, it says that the children were being pimped out in the neighborhoods to other adults, neighbors, to everyone. And what's interesting is that there were no other arrests made. It was just strictly the Dunnans and the Ballards. All these other people that these kids said that they were abused by, neighbors, you think they'd be easily approached and questioned, but this never took place.
And some of these other persons were named. It wasn't just a neighbor or somebody from Boulder. Some of these persons were named in the affidavit.
There were no other people named in the affidavit. They said that there were strangers. They said neighbors.
Other kids.
Other children. The thing is that they just focused on the four, and that was it.
Right.
Even though the kids talked about being taken to other places, made to have, brutally raped in front of many adults, other children were there. Nobody looked into it. You know, this case had the largest task force at the time in Colorado history. You had Longmont, Lafayette, Boulder, social services, mental health. It was this huge task force, but yet they only focused on the four, and these people were also picture takers. So they took pictures and possibly film. So how they did not look for other people, we can't find it. We can't find any paperwork on the task force, even though it was the largest one in the state's history. We can't find anything. It was the jail sentence that was truly amazing. Just on the incest alone, you could have locked these people up for life.
Right.
Never mind the torture, the pimping out to, the other, having them pimped out to other people. I think Michael Ballard was given 10 years. I think his wife was, I think she served 5. What was Dennis Dunnan's wife's name, Jim? I forgot that one.
That name escapes me, but she got off scot-free.
Yeah, she didn't do a day in jail. And Dennis Dunnan got life.
Yeah, and so I think Ballard did 8.5.
Yeah, he did 8.5 maybe. So, but Dennis Dunnan got life. Because, once again, the Boulder County District Attorney's Office pled these people down. This was such a disgusting plea that there were attorneys involved in this case that left the district attorney's office. They just didn't leave the district attorney's office. They stopped being attorneys because they were so disgusted on what happened. And everybody complained about the pleas. The kids complained about it. Social workers complained about it, but yet they did it anyway.
And Nick, I was able to reach out to somebody that was very close to that case that knew what was going on in the DA's office at that time, and also was close to the kids as well. And this person relayed to me that this case was a hot potato at the DA's office. Nobody wanted to handle it.
Right.
And this person said that the children were treated in a hostile manner by the DA's office. The kids were very uncomfortable and they were treated poorly. And this person did not understand why they were handling them. They were getting threats in a sense, like some kids were in the hospital and they were threatening the kids by saying, if you don't come to the DA's office, we're not going to press charges. Stuff like that. Very bizarre how they handled this case. And eventually, my brother and I were able to track down one of the child victims in the case, lived out in the Midwest. I was able to talk with him on the phone briefly because he kind of was caught off guard. But when I mentioned the case to him, after his initial shock of kind of being brought back up, he settled down and he said that he had a fear of police officers in this case. I said, well, why do you have a fear of police officers? And he said this, he goes, they were orchestrating the abuse. That's how he said it to me. And I said, where? And he said, Boulder, Longmont. And I said, okay. So at one point I was able, I took a reporter, me and a reporter, I went out from Maine.
Jim, and who told us to go out to the Midwest to interview him?
He did.
No. Who told us to do it?
Do
you remember?
Can't
Ollie
say.
Gray. Ollie Gray. We told Ollie Gray this information about what one of the Ballard, what the Ballard kid had said to my brother.
Right.
And Ollie was like, you need, you know, because of his health issues at the time, he couldn't travel. So he begged us to do it. He found it to be that important.
Yeah. So once I got out there with the reporter, I had conversations with the Ballard kid, and he said he was going to show, but eventually he backed out. So it was kind of a failed trip on the sense that he wouldn't show up to speak further on it. When he mentioned the police orchestrating the abuse, that's what I really wanted to dig deep into. But when you look at the affidavit and you start reading through the police narrative, one of the girls mentions at one of these get-togethers where they're being abused and they're being sexually abused, she said, oh, well, I thought we were going to get money for it, but I never received any. And then she said there was a policeman there. And I told him that I'm being abused here. And it says in the affidavit, when she told this quote unquote policeman that, the policeman and Mike Ballard laughed together. That says that right in the affidavit. I was just reading it today, in a matter of fact.
Welcome to Boulder County.
That the girl said that she reported it to a policeman who was there, and the policeman and Mike Ballard laughed.
And there's also in the affidavits, police officers going to the home at different times during the day, you know, showing up in uniform. Now, we're not saying that the entire Boulder Police Department was involved or Longmont, but all it takes is one or two. And it's these are disturbing allegations that were made. And it's no wonder Ollie Gray wanted us to go out there and try to get more information. And unfortunately, the kid didn't, you know, he got nervous and didn't show, but he had said enough to my brother on the phone.
It was almost the perfect crime. Everyone was distracted, their attention elsewhere. Stacks of cold, hard cash sitting on the table unguarded. Who wouldn't be tempted to slowly reach their hand out and steal a pile of Monopoly money from the banker? Monopoly is one of those games that can bring out everyone's most devious selves. And Monopoly Go takes that gleeful mischievousness to your phone in a wildly popular twist on the classic game that you can play throughout your day, anywhere, anytime. Collect rent from friends on iconic properties. Bankrupt them by pulling a heist on their vault. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with friends to unlock big prizes and try to top the leaderboards. Whether you're helping out your friends or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is an absolute blast. Download it now free on the App Store or Google Play.
Do you want to set your child up for success? Of course you do. That's why you need to check out IXL Learning today. IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids covering math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed to help them really understand and master topics in a fun way. It's powered by advanced algorithms. IXL gives the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. There's one site for all kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Kids could use it at home on their computer or on an app on your phone or a tablet. No more grading those worksheets. IXL grades everything for you. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. I love recommending IXL Learning. Kids can learn at home or on the go. And all my friends and family that are using it absolutely love it because it's so easy to set up and so easy to use. And even the kids that I've recommended it to their parents have told me, hey, Captain, thank you. I was having problems in math and my parents couldn't help me, but IXL could. Do you want to get your kids back on track or do you just want to get your kids ahead? Do so with IXL Learning. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And True Crime Garage listeners get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/garage. Visit IXL.com/garage to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price. Check out IXL.com/garage today.
Have you ever thought about why your wireless bill is so damn expensive? It's all just radio waves. And how much can radio waves really cost? It seems like Big Wireless all got together and decided $100 a month. Now, thanks to Mint Mobile, you have a choice. For a limited time, all phone plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plan's jaw-dropping monthly bills and unexpected overages. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. So ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited-time deal and get premium wireless for just $15 a month. I love Mint Mobile. They have great quality. They have wonderful service. I love saving money. Put them together, and I'm getting great quality, great service, a wonderful phone plan for only $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
The Zell brothers are investigating Boulder, the time period leading up to the JonBenet Ramsey murder case, and even the city afterward. If anyone has any tips, they're looking for information in all of the cases that we've just discussed, as well as anything that was going on that was not on the up and up in Boulder in the 1990s and after. And if anybody has information or would like to speak with one of the Zell brothers or both, please use this email address, jbrtips@gmail.com. Once again, that's jbrtips@gmail.com. What we are seeing here time and time again, and what these cases point out, is a flawed history of the town of Boulder and the persons that are supposed to be responsible for investigating horrific crimes. And a lot of the crimes we just talked about, crimes against children. And you're seeing repeatedly failed investigations, failed follow-ups, a failure to convict these individuals to the fullest extent of the law. They are soft on crime in Boulder, and they are soft on crimes against children in Boulder at this time period.
And that's what we call, that's the Boulder syndrome. This is what we're talking about. This repeats over and over for decades throughout the, you know, Alex Hunter's tenure. We've spoken to people. We've spoken to former detectives who worked at the Boulder Police Department. And, you know, everybody says the same thing. The plea bargains were out of control. Everybody says it. And one thing we didn't mention with the Ballard case My brother talked about the judge that the kids were brought before, and the judge refused to take them out of the home. That judge, his name was Judge Belapani. That name may not sound familiar to people who follow the Ramsey case, but he was the judge who was put in charge of the grand jury in the Ramsey case. And during the grand jury process, he recused himself and left the country, went to Egypt. He did this out of nowhere. He just came out, you know, I think he sat the grand jurors and then all of a sudden said, I quit. I'm going to Egypt to teach law. So there's the connection between the Ballard case and the Ramsey case with that one.
Well, and to kind of fill in the listeners here a little bit, if anybody's out there shaking their heads going, I don't know, this seems like a lot to believe. Anybody that's read JonBenet Inside the Ramsey Murder Investigation by Steve Thomas, who was the detective and one-time lead on the case, the very beginning of his book, he's a police officer. He's a detective working for Boulder, for the city of Boulder. And he spends the beginning of his book talking about how outrageous and how plea deals were a common theme in the county courts out there in Boulder leading up to the murder of JonBenet.
And I think Stephen Singular, the author who wrote Presumed Guilty, actually there's a part in the book where he's interviewing Detective Wickman. Mm-hmm. And Wickman hints to something and says, you know, I was looking to arrest a city councilman, but I don't have the book in front of me, but to paraphrase, you know, I was told to back down. That's what you're dealing with in Boulder. So when you start building these cases up, is it really any wonder why this case isn't solved? And it gets worse. I mean, the Ballard case is really horrific, but these cases keep on going.
One, for example, is the Jerry Berry case, right? That's a child pornography case.
Oh, absolutely. Jerry Berry. This is one of my favorites.
And he lived relatively close to the Ramseys, correct?
Well, he didn't live really close, okay. But he worked as the treasurer for First Baptist Church.
Okay.
Which was pretty much down the block and across the street from St. John's Episcopal, the Ramsey Church, mm-hmm. which is minutes away from the Ramsey home. But Jerry Berry. So he's the treasurer for First Baptist Church. He's arrested, and this was, I want to say, 1999. So First Baptist used to have a program where they helped families that were down on their luck. And a woman shows up with, you know, with three kids, three girls, and of course they're going to help them out. Jerry Berry is going to take a personal interest in him. So he starts to take the kids to his house with the mother's permission. And eventually what happens is that he starts taking pictures of them in different states of undress. Now these girls were, I think, 4, 5, and 7. And strangely enough, they had a brother, and the brother from the town they came from, which escapes me at the moment, the brother was in jail for molesting his sisters.
That's right.
These girls already went through the ringer with their brother. Now the mother takes them to First Baptist Church. They're going to get help. And Jerry Berry is the one that's going to help them. And he, like I said, he starts taking pictures of him in different state, you know, topless. He shows the pictures to the mother. She's fine with it. So what does that tell you? The mother's okay with what he's doing. And then, you know, the molestation starts in the bathtub. Well, I'm not going to go in. The kids were so young, I'm not really going to go into it.
Right.
So then they make an arrest. They arrest him. They take out filmmaking equipment from his house, cameras. That's how he even got arrested, was he brought film to be developed And the person developing the film back in 1999 saw what was on the camera and called the cops. And that's how they arrested him. So they got him dead to rights. Then we're told he actually has a prior in another state for the same thing. They surmise that he is also a child pornographer.
And that's coming because I wound up getting in touch with one of the officers directly involved in the case itself. And that question I posed directly to the officer, I said, was he involved in child pornography? And they said, yes, we believe he was a child pornographer in the area. That's what he was doing.
For his own use or for to sell or trade?
For apparently both personal and to sell, because they brought in the postal service to track where the pornography was going and to who. And that's when the investigation got shut down. Plea bargain.
Of course.
And the officer I was talking with when I mentioned, you know, what the thoughts were when the plea bargain came down, this officer said, I literally fell off my chair. It's a quote.
I mean, how could you not be shocked? And that person that worked on that case wound up leaving. I would too. I think she went to the West Coast. But another plea bargain.
When you have as the district attorney, you have the photographs and you've traced and tracked photographs and child pornography that was sent through the U.S. mail, and yet you're still. At that point, there's no reason for a plea bargain. You have the evidence to show the jury, look how disgusting this person is, the laws that he's breaking. He's not fit to live in our society. He belongs behind bars. You wouldn't find a jury that wouldn't convict that guy. And yet you're letting him get a plea bargain.
Yeah, it gets more interesting once the plea bargain is handed down. Jerry Berry breaks parole.
Well, wait. First, whoa. Before you get to the parole,
yeah.
To get to Nick's point that he just made, what I think happened is that they didn't want to know who else had the pornography.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they shut the case down, pled the case out. But here's the thing. Now, remember, this is 1999. This isn't 1977. This isn't Slusher times. This is 1999. This is nearly 3 years after the murder of JonBenet Ramsey. You figure you want to make an example out of these people, right?
Yep.
You figure the town has learned its lesson that they're going to get hard on pedophiles. They plead them out to house arrest, no jail time, lifetime probation.
So your sentence is to be sent and confined to the place that you were committing a lot of these crimes.
And obviously no contact with children, a lifetime, you know, probation, you know, you can, you know, that's it. You're on the hook now. You know, you got to watch your steps. So he breaks parole. He breaks it. He breaks the probation. So for sure they send him to jail. No. He doesn't go to jail. Then he breaks the probation a second time. Now that's the one for sure. They're going to send him to the slammer. Nope. Doesn't happen. A third time. Nope. Doesn't happen. Four times it took.
Now it starts to get to the point where, and this is what Ollie Gray always told me about the Ramsey case. He's like, you want to get to the bottom of what happened? Figure out who knew who. That's how this case is going to get solved. And you get people to talk. And that's how you do it. He would tell me that almost every time we talked. Why was Jerry Berry in 1999 given, especially in a short span after the murder of JonBenet Ramsey, given that kind of treatment? Who was he giving pornography to? Who was he selling to? Was that what they were afraid of? That he knew names? This guy was wealthy. He owned 14 cars. No license, though. And he owned a company called Berry Enterprises, which was obviously a front company that nobody could figure out. Even Lou Smith couldn't figure out what that company was doing. We have an idea, but nobody could pin it down and have actual proof of what that company really did. Mm-hmm. So that's the Berry case.
Let's expand on your guys' knowledge. And you did a little look into the background of Alex Hunter, who, as we just discussed, was the person in charge and could have put a lot of these terrible people away for a very, very long time. And maybe, you know, was a little relaxed in that effort. But tell us a little bit more about the background of Alex Hunter, the district attorney.
Oh, I think I said it earlier. He came into office in 1972. I guess he thought he was a real estate mogul back then, because he was into real estate, making a bunch of deals with his law partner at the time, who was also involved in those land deals, Bill Wise. And the deals went south, and he was pretty much bankrupted. He owed creditors, I think, he filed for bankruptcy in 74, 28 secured creditors, another dozen unsecured creditors, and I think he owed him $6 million. This is your district attorney, and this is when he first starts. That's the beginning of Alex Hunter, and he initially ran on a hard line against crime when he first started, and the defense attorneys in the area complained that their workload was too much, so they ended it. And that's when the plea bargain train got rolling and never stopped. You know, he's been married four times. That's pretty much it for Alex Hunter, for his basic background.
A person to be in that position and to be that much in debt is an obvious. It's very easy to go from that to being compromised, number one. And then number two here with Alex Hunter, he's in office till what, roughly 2000, 2001?
He retired. Yeah, I think he stepped down in 2000. That's a long time to be in office. It's like your own little kingdom.
Yeah.
You know, he spent 28 years in office, and he always ran unopposed. But what brought him down was the Ramsey case.
Well, and you're going to have somebody out there that's going to say, but Nick, you know, you're saying he's letting these sickos plea out to shorter sentences, maybe no jail time, but he ran on a platform on being tough on crime. Well, my response to that would be, if that's your argument, look, nobody's ever won an election by announcing that they're going to be soft on crime. So it's just part of the packaging for getting that job, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it's part of the political world.
That's right. Now, what I thought was so much fun, I had talked to you guys a handful of times and very much enjoyed our conversations. And then I sat down and I read Stephen Singular's very good book, Presumed Guilty, and I had no clue that this was going to happen. At some point, he starts talking about you guys, and he referred to it as the Zell Brothers probe, the Zell Brothers investigation into the JonBenet Ramsey case. And so talk about what it is that you guys set out to do in 1997, and maybe some of the more famous individuals or people that are very close to this case that you met and interacted with along the way.
Well, as I had mentioned earlier, in 1997, we literally got involved in this case almost from the beginning. I think we started looking into it, Jim, what, about 3 days after?
Yeah, it was right away.
Yeah, the 29th of 96. And I don't know if you want us to mention how we got going on our, I guess we can mention it, if we can do it quick.
Yeah.
So 1996, we start looking into it, and you know, to us, it just the whole thing looked off. And that's when I called my brother and I said, Jim, you know, maybe we should just take a look around the town, you know, see if this is in our wheelhouse. And it didn't take long, just a couple of days. And my brother will tell you the phone call that set us off on a 27-year journey.
Well, before we get into 27 years, originally you thought you would solve this in how long?
Oh, well, I originally told my brother, I said, Jim, this won't take long, probably a year.
Welcome on.
Missed it by that much.
Beautiful. But it wasn't for a lack of trying, right?
Yes, yes. Well, no.
So tell us about the phone call.
You know, you're talking about the early days of the internet, right? So where do you really go to get your information about a town? You know, you always go to the library. You know, that was your resource. That's where the history of a town is. It's a town's memory is the library. The people that work at the library know the people of the town. So that's who I called. I called the Boulder Library, and I asked to speak to someone, and they put me on. I don't know if it was the head librarian. It was just a librarian. And I asked her a very simple question. I said, I'm calling in regards to this case of this little girl. I said, is this the first time that's ever happened? Or, I mean, is this usual? Oh, what happens here? And, you know, can you give me, you know, what do you think happened? And she said, well, and this is what she said. Things happen to our kids here in Boulder that we don't like to talk about. And then she said, to be honest with you, I'm a little uncomfortable talking with you on the phone about it. So I'm going to go. And then I said, I said, okay, things happen to our kids here that we don't like to talk about.
That almost sounds like right out of the novel Stephen King's It, right?
Yeah. There's
something going on here with the kids, and they're getting pulled and vanishing off the streets. And but we're so unsettled with everything that we don't even discuss it.
Yeah. So that's when I called my brother. I say, hey, Frank, you know, I think we need to look at this a little further.
Yeah, and then I found a mechanic who didn't go that far, but talked about rumors of things happening to kids. And then we were kind of off and running. And we formed our theory of the case probably midway through January 1997. And we called it the sex ring case. And as I said earlier, we do not believe that John and Patsy Ramsey killed their daughter. Not at all. We believe that they may have been involved in something that led to their daughter being killed, and then for whatever reason helped cover it up. That was our theory. And we had certain goals that we wanted to, I shouldn't call them goals. We thought if our theory was going to be correct, that certain things were going to happen. And me and my brother have worked other cases over the years. And when you start to predict the future of the case or things that happen in the case and you're predicting it ahead of time, you're usually on the right track.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, okay, sex ring theory. You know, were there sex rings in the town? We found that out relatively quickly that there were sex rings operating in Boulder. In the Ramsey case, we would have to find someone who would come forward and accuse either John, Patsy, or someone close to them of child sexual abuse. So we started digging in Boulder. Now, meanwhile, while we're looking for that witness, and I had a plan for sure, that if we found the witness that would make that claim, at the time, I had a place that they could stay. We'd get them out of Boulder. I'd get them on the East Coast, put them up. That way they'd have no worries. Hire private investigators to investigate their claims. And then get a reporter to write an article on what the private investigators could prove. And hence put pressure on the Boulder Police Department.
That was the goal, to find the witness. And then lo and behold, a witness comes forward, but just not as we thought it would be which would be locally in Boulder. This witness came from California, and she came forward. She was under therapeutic care. She was, and the therapist she was seeing said, yes, you know, what she's saying is valid, because her claim that she was abused in California, right? What reminded her, when she heard about the JonBenet case, she was like, hey, not only was she abused the way I was abused, but there are players that are involved with her that were involved in my abuse.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. Make sure you join me back here in the garage for part two with the Zell brothers. Until then, be good, be kind, and don't litter.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.